Tonight on Arena. On TV, the Four Seasons, Kareem and Suspect is what we've been watching, and we've been listening to new albums from Suzanne Vega, Blondshell and Car Seat Headrest. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Television first this evening. We'll be travelling back in time to the Napoleonic era with Kareem, French historical drama from Apple TV. This is based on Ian Kelly's book Cooking for Kings, The Life of Antoine Carême, or Kareem, the first celebrity chef. It stars Benjamin Voisin as the titular Kareem, and the series portrays his rise from poverty to culinary fame, his meetings with Napoleon, Tsar Alexander, and blends drama and history, and a fair amount of fiction, I would guess, to tell us about Kareem's extraordinary life. We are back in modern times with a gritty drama on Disney Plus, Suspect. This is the shooting of Jean-Charles Menezes. It explores the tragic real-life events surrounding the death of Jean-Charles de Menezes, a Brazilian electrician mistakenly identified as a terrorist by London police in 2005. And this series delves into the aftermath of the 7/7 bombings and the subsequent failed attacks, highlighting the flawed intelligence that led to the death of the Brazilian electrician. But first, Netflix brings us The Four Seasons, a new comedy based on the 1981 film written, starring and directed by Alan Alda. This version is co-created by and stars Tina Fey. It follows three suburban couples as they holiday together each season, navigates the ups and downs of their lives and their relationships. Tensions arise within the group when one couple splits and a younger girlfriend appears on subsequent trips. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser are with me in studio. 1981, in the Alan Alda film, was a pretty good film. I remember it used to be on quite late at night when it came to the telly in my memory. But here we are with this, The Four Seasons 2.0. We're up. We're in 2025, Chris.
We are, yes. And it wasn't. This isn't an obvious choice for Tina Fey and her collaborators to make, because I think people have been wondering what she is going to do next. And I thought maybe we were going to get an original piece from Tina Fey. Because to me, despite the fact that the original Four Seasons released in 1981, it is a good film. It's a good term from Alan Alda, who was, you know, multitasking there. He was writing, directing, and starring in this thing, and it has been turned into a series before. I thought maybe it had slipped out of the public conscience a little bit, but not Tina Fey's. So she has given it a little bit of an upgrade, you know, a sprinkling of kind of, you know, the contemporary era here and there, like, you know, Danny and Claudia from the original film are now Danny and Claude, a gay couple played by Coleman Domingo, is one of the partners there. There were no, obviously, people of colour in the original version, so Tina Fey and her collaborators have fixed that. But it's still very much the same idea of six friends from college doing everything they can over the course of 20, 30 years to keep that friendship going, but also to keep their own, you know, personal relationships going. And they're committed to doing this thing where, you know, Case, Tina Fey's character, four times a year organises a trip away for them so that they can, you know, continue to hang out. So the title is not just a reference to the fact that they go on these quarterly vacations, but also the fact that, as in the original film, Vivaldi's compositions, The Four Seasons, soundtrack these holidays.
I know anybody who's seen the original film may well know which couple is in trouble, or which of the couples, or maybe all of them are
in trouble.
And which couple splits and what happens subsequently. So let's just keep a couple splits and a new girlfriend appears. Let's just keep that as our modus operandi. These are pretty wealthy. This is an old one. These are pretty wealthy, pretty privileged. I don't think they're as obnoxious as many of the contemporary series have given of people like this, but they're fairly comfortable and fairly insulated.
Yeah, like, they're not talking White Lotus levels here. It's more relatable than that, I think. So you're not saying completely over the top wealthy.
They're solid
like middle class, and you get that vibe where, I think, because the cast is so good, like Steve Carell, Coleman Domingo, Tina Fey, Will Forte, because they have actual friendships outside of that, you can tell that the marriages feel lived in. They do. They feel convincing.
And you believe that these six would be on a holiday together.
I mean, weirdly enough, I have to say, Tina Fey and Will Forte, who are one of the couples, Jack and Kate, they actually have the least chemistry, I thought, out of the bunch, even though their story is quite interesting. And I think a lot of viewers will kind of dig into it because, I mean, every single one relationship breaks down, as you said, and that puts all the other relationships under the microscope. Yeah. So what you're seeing is when you go away with, you know, couples, friends, you all have these in-jokes and you all have the secrets that you want to, you know, reveal or conceal, and you want to tell one person something about what happened, or you want to keep, you know, the gossip at a distance from another person. But then this is also about what happens behind the closed doors. Yes. When you go up to the bedroom at night and you're, you know, the door is closed, it's about who you're talking about, what couples you're talking about, but also it's about the fights that you have that you don't want the other couples to know about.
Yes.
And it's about, like, there is, Tina Fey's spiky. Her comedy is not about lessons learned. There's not a lot of fuzziness here. There's not a lot of hugging and learning. This is the sharp end of the stick that you're getting here.
She's the one that sets all the schedules and tells people to be ready at 14:21.
Yeah.
Not at 20 past two, 14:21.
But you can see that within the relationship, her and Will Forte's character, Jack, he's the more laid back one, and she hates having to be the mean mommy all the time. So, well, I think that's relatable for a lot of people.
Let's listen to a scene featuring Tina Fey, in fact, and Will Forte. This is from quite early on. They've all arrived at Nick and Anne's house. Nick and Anne are celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary. That's coincided with this year's trip. And Tina, or Will Forte as Jack, makes a little speech.
Okay, I'd like to make a toast to Nick and Anne on their 25th.
Aww.
You guys are an inspiration. You built this beautiful life together, and I hope you know how lucky you are. So many other people have split up or hate each other, or they become those couples where their whole personality is just making craft beer. Ugh, fuck them. Look, it is rare in this life to find your soulmate. And yet, somehow, all six of us have done it. To Nick and Anne.
Cheers.
Nick and Anne, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.
So nicely said, honey. Even though soulmates aren't a real thing.
What? How can you say that?
Of course soulmates are real.
You really believe there is one person, for every person on it, there's one person in the whole earth that they're supposed to be with, and then that person also happens to be in the same dorm at college?
So do you not love me?
I love you so much, but we're not lucky, we're dedicated. Romantic love fades.
Jesus!
And then you build something deeper!
Who invited the incel? Love is the point of everything. It defines us as human beings.
Yeah.
Yes, but also dolphins feel it.
Dolphins do feel it, I am sure. And that's the kind, that's the nature of the beast here in the various, I've only seen two episodes at this point, Chris. But, you know, they're sitting down around dinner. They're going to have these type of conversations that are philosophical and are all about relationships and will show the holes in the various relationships that are there.
That's pretty much it. It's doing the same thing that the original Alda film did. You know, it's talking about these relationships, some of which, you know, it's telling you, oh, these relationships are in trouble, but it's the relationships on the side that might actually be in trouble. And we're also talking about six different types of midlife crisis here as well. And that's a, and although, you know, we will be critiquing the show, that sort of storytelling wheel is very difficult to reinvent. So I don't really think Tina Fey or Lang Fisher or Tracy Wigfield, I don't really think they're trying to reinvent it. They're just trying to see what this story looks like, what Alan Alda's story looks like 40 or 50 years later. And I think there were times where I wanted the writing to be sharper. Maybe I wanted the punchlines to be, you know, that little bit, just have a bit more of a punch to it. But I think maybe that Tina Fey is thinking, well, look, this show can survive on the charm of its cast. It does, but it never really thrives, given how good that cast are.
Yeah, they are pretty good.
Yeah, it never really, it's not up
and
there.
And I do have to say, I defy anybody not to have a huge lump in their throat when Alan Alda, the 89-year-old Alan Alda, and he's one of the couples, he's the father, and they call him daddy, and you think when that these comedians are saying that as much to him as at the daddy of their comedy.
When she hugs him, when Tina Fey hugs him, as they're both their characters, like as she says, "I love you. I need to tell you, I love you." That felt so poignant to me, definitely, and it was a gorgeous like callback and respectfulness there. But I have to say, like, this show like is powered by the charisma of its cast. It really is, because as Chris was saying, you do want the jokes to be funnier. You want it to be have a little bit more bite to it. Now, they're, in saying that, there are great,
I did get a few
there
laughs.
Are really good one line. one-liners, but I have to say, for me, Colman Domingo powers this show. Yeah. His performance as Danny.
He's one half of the gay couple.
Yeah, yeah, Danny and Claude. And he is just, he's supposed to be suffering from a heart condition, just to say, but this man looks glowing with good health. This man is so handsome. Yep. But also, he is just the most interesting character. And him and Tina Fey were old college friends, it's supposed to be their characters, and also were once, you know, paramours back in the day. Mm. And they have this great lived-in friendship that you feel like they both roll their eyes in unison at the same things. We want to be in other conversations in the wine bar. I found him like so interesting that I wanted him to kind of go off and do his own show. Yeah. I want to see a show that's like Sex in the City with like Danny and Claude have this open marriage and it's not really talked about, or, you know, as in it's not gone scrutinized or anything by the other friends. It's just accepted as part that's of the landscape of the friendship and their marriage. And I think that was great. I want that show of Colman Domingo being like, a man in his 50s traversing this life.
That relationship to Claude, now I don't know how Italians will feel this over the top Italian singer, like terrible kind of smolchy stuff that he sings. But the relationship between those two men, it was Claudia, it was, who was it that played it in the original?
Rita Moreno.
The relationship between Claude and Danny, really interesting. And interesting how they navigate the difference between lying and kind of maybe things you don't tell because you're afraid that it'll cause a bigger problem if I tell it.
Yeah, that is actually one of the more interesting relationships in the show, more so than the Will Forte and the Faye relationship, because you slowly start to see that Colman Domingo's character, Danny, he's been micromanaging their relationship, and he's been thinking that if he doesn't tell his husband all of these things, that he'll just get stressed about, that his life will be easier. But what he's doing is he's shielding part of himself, and he's, you know, putting away this part of the relationship that, you know, Claude doesn't want him to, and he's lying to him essentially, and that eventually breaks him down, especially when it comes to him, not doing anything to he's supposed to be having surgery on his heart and his husband wants him to, but he lies and says that he's away for work. That's going to hurt the relationship. Just going back to the Alan Alda.
It might hurt his heart too,
but just going back to the Alan Alda cameo, I think that cameo is important for two reasons. One is that it just reminds you that even, you know, legends like Alan Alda aren't immune from time. I mean, the whole time I was watching it, I was just thinking, God, time catches up with us all and this is so sad. But two, he still has it, and he has it to the point where I was mentioning that the punchline should have more bite. His 2 minutes on screen do something that the other 4 hours can't achieve, which is that they make you laugh hysterically. Mm. And I think that made me think that's what's missing here. There's no real laugh out loud moments. It's very charming, very sweet, and it passes the time nicely. Oh. But there you go. There's Alan Alda calling. He approves.
That's Tina Fey actually going, excuse me, my one-liners are great.
It does what it needs to, but needed more Alda.
More Alda, please. I lost my train of thought now. That phone call coming through. They're half-hour episodes. Mm. I wanted it to be a bit longer. I could have taken the hour. How many episodes have
There's
we got?
Eight. Six of them, and I wanted to gobble up the last two, definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it is an examination of these marriages, and it really is about digging into the idea of marriage as a whole, as this long haul flight that you might want to escape from, but you're afraid to, you know, employ the parachute, and you might as well just continue on to your destination and see what happens. And I find that interesting, and it was, but it just needed a little bit more spice to it for me.
And long haul flights can be enjoyable,
of course they can,
as well. There's also that aspect to life. Stars from you, Jen.
People might find it a little bit too cynical for their taste. It's not a Nancy Myers, you know, trip through suburbia. I would give it, you know, three for Colman Domingo, an amazing performance as usual.
And what are you saying?
It's not the worst thing in the world to watch Tina Fey, Colman Domingo. I was going to say, it's not the worst thing in the world to watch Colman and Tina and Steve basically drink wine and talk about their lives. So three stars
from you, and I'm giving an extra one for Alan Alda's 2 minutes.
Yes,
you
know, that's five-star stuff.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay, let's move on. And it's on Netflix, by the way. Let's move on then to Kareem, real-life celebrity chef from Napoleonic era. Chris, there's an exploding cake.
There is.
Before the credits even roll, there's an exploding cake.
And
you're shown pretty quickly that food and sex are going to be intimately related for the rest of the series.
Yes, so we have a cake blowing up in the title sequence, and then the first, the introduction to the series, the first time that we see Kareem, played by Benjamin Voisin, he is on the floor of his adoptive father's pastry shop, basically, with his on-off girlfriend, Henriette. And he is having her try out his different whipped cream recipes, which is not a new euphemism, but
it could be.
That right
it could
there
be in that scene.
But that right there tells you everything you need to know about this series, which though,
certainly in terms of the food. But what about the history?
Yeah, well, it is based, in fact. I mean, it is based on a nonfiction book by Ian Kelly about the world's first celebrity chef, and that's the way Marie-Antoine or Antonin Karim was known. He was a very famous patissier during Napoleon's time, and he really did, you know, he really did become this very successful pastry chef in Paris. He really did work for a slippery diplomat at the time, but I don't think, Sean, that he was a spy. But this series goes, but what if he was? And what if he used not just his talents in the kitchen, but also his talents in the bedroom to get ahead and also to help other power players get ahead? And what if he annoyed Napoleon in the process?
Yeah, and we're in the Napoleonic era at this point in history, Jen. I think the history is fairly loose, but the machinations and the Machiavellian politician seems very familiar.
Like, this is, you know, Bridgerton meets Bake Off, like, in that way. It's, you know, we had Carmi and the bear, and now we have Karem and Napoleon. And it's like Kitchen Nightmares atmosphere, but the stakes are a little bit higher because it's the fate of the whole of France depends on this young chef. And that is definitely more unsettling than Paul Hollywood telling you you have a soggy bottom. Although there are bottoms aplenty in this adaptation.
Oh, look what you did there. Between that and the creamy what?
We're not going to talk about them again.
The disarming thing about this is, though, that Benjamin Voisin looks so like a Jedward that I had to look away many times when any kind of scenes, kind of lusty scenes were happening. It's very strange. But it has that kind of maximalist feel that you would get from those 1980s versions of, like, the new romantic versions of the court of Napoleon. So it kind of looks
even
like
a big Dickens, you know, or a Victor Hugo type of
it looks
scenario.
Like everybody, you know, himself, Karem, looks like he is stepped off a Visage video. It's all like rock and roll, leather trousers, that hair earring. He is to, I don't know, cooking what Lovejoy was to antiques in that way. Do you know what I mean? He's the Casanova of cake, basically. So, I mean, you're looking, it is, the history is dispensed kind of, it's there, but it's like, you know, Talleyrand, he works for Talleyrand, who is
the,
you know,
politician,
this diplomat.
Guy.
Yeah, so he gets into the orbit of Napoleon and Josephine, but it's basically him using his charms to kind of infiltrate their world. And then you have, like, Fouché, who is this chief of police that's on his trail. Now, I have to say, like, Michel Escott, who plays him, is very chilling but also really campy. It kind of feels like something out of Les Miserables sometimes. You see him. But he has a great presence. He's like this big giant heron come to life almost. He's stalking his prey. Like,
And the other aspect that struck me about this, I mean, it's kind of, it's very rambling in the opening sections.
Yes.
But by the end of the first episode, I was kind of hooked in, and I thought, I'd like to watch another episode of that now.
Oh, yeah.
To look at, and particularly, I don't know whether this character is developed, the character of Agathe, played by Elise Deleuze, who's this, she's the second in command in the kitchen, and herself and Karim, I'm guessing, in cooking terms, start to have wonderful recipes together.
They do start to have wonderful recipes together. They also have a rule from the beginning, which is that they won't sleep with one another. So you know that that's definitely going to go somewhere. Their relationship is fun to watch. They have a fun partnership in the kitchen. But it's, and you're right, actually, it's a little bit hard to follow, a bit confusing at the beginning, because there's this whole big mess in his life where, you know, who were his real mother and father? What's his relationship like with Sylvain, who is his adopted father? What happened to his adopted sister? Why does he blame Napoleon on the death, and why also does he make this decision to save Napoleon's life? Because for the rest of the series then he's so hot headed and he's so kind of, you know, he speaks before he thinks, but, you know, here he had plenty of time to think and he still saved his life. So he's a bit of a contradiction at the beginning, but he's also fascinating to watch. Now, I don't know how much of that is down to the fact that he looks like he's in, as Jen says, a music video. He looks like Paolo Nutini at times, and the real
Edward and Paolo Nutini.
Yeah, there you go. And I don't think the real Antonin looked like that, but there is some fun to be had with this idea of this chef in the Napoleonic era who wields these, you know, unconventional talents that he has, you know, as I say, in the kitchen and also the bedroom, to get ahead in circles that he never expected to be
in. And also there's this idea that what you do for a recipe is the same as how you court somebody or how you seduce somebody, but also that cooking and politics are not that far apart.
Exactly. And there's also this whole vibe to, well, like, about the fact that Napoleon has no taste, and it's all about bringing him into the world of of creativity of cooking and learning to explore like different directions of food. And anybody who's read Jeanette Winterson's The Passion will know that Napoleon's obsessed with chicken. There wasn't many chickens in this, I have to say, but there's a lot of cakes. I think if you enjoy that, it's ridiculous. It's a romp. It's like, you know, it's a show that says desserts can bring nations together, drive married couples apart and seduce, you know, the powerful and the wealthy. So if that sounds like your thing, it's there in spades. It's there in
stars.
I have to say,
top
I give it.
Tonight, Jen.
I mean, it's a sweet confection, if you want to say that. I'll give it a three.
God, you've been getting yourself so riled up for the bank holiday weekend. Exactly. Must be that's exciting you. Wonderful verbiage coming from you this evening. Let's go with your stars then, Chris.
Yeah, look, it's Bond, The Bear and Bridgerton. So I think that's a tasty mix. I'm going to go with 3-2.
Oh, you're all at it. and verbiage of a high quality, let me be clear on that, Jen. So a high 3, you said, was it?
Chris? High 3, we'll go with a high 3.
High 3s from both of you. Let us move on then to Jeff Pope's drama, Suspect, the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menzies. We're in a totally different world here for sure, Jen, and the tone is incredibly different. From the outset, I must say, this was so tense to watch. It's the real life events of the 7th of July, 2005.
And I mean, Jeff Pope is pulling no punches here, like with the rage and frustration that he feels about this story and the bureaucracy involved in this whole case.
Just remind us of the attacks that happened on that day, 7/7/2005.
Yeah, so there was the terrorist bombings across London, like in the Piccadilly, the Underground, and also on a bus as well. And they start things by getting you right into that carnage of like the 7th of July 2005, and not by showing the bombings happening across London. It's the aftermath with the forensic officers. They have to arrive looking at this blown up tube carriage and inside the depths of the Piccadilly line.
And they don't spare us, not necessarily visually, but in terms of description, there's no sparing us the detail
here. You see, you know, Daniel Mays, who's a great actor, you see him and he's this hardened principal investigator. You see him leave.
Forensic investigator.
Yeah, you see him leave the tube station. He's emerging from Russell Square station and he's so shocked and he's so desperate looking that that's all you actually need to know in a way, like of how horrific it was.
Let's listen to a clip, and this is from the Cobra meeting that was happened that took place obviously very quickly after it became clear that there were a number of attacks around London, and in this we will hear Assistant Chief Commissioner, this is Andy Heyman, played by Max Beasley. All of these are real people, played by Max Beasley. He attends a Cobra meeting to update the Home Secretary and his team. You'll hear Niamh Cusack's voice in the middle of this as Eliza Manning Buller. You'll hear Ian Pulliston Davies as Charles Clark, who was the Home Secretary at the time.
But our initial analysis is that there appears to be no intelligence which might have predicted today's events.
Thank you. Andy, what can you tell us?
Well, as yet, no organisation has claimed responsibility, and I'm afraid there's still a lot of confusion.
What are we talking about? Suicide bombers? Remote devices?
We don't know yet. We have teams at the trains, but the conditions underground are so difficult that we can't even be 100% certain how many fatalities there are.
Why not, can I ask?
The heat is extreme. It's over 40 degrees down there. That's causing all sorts of issues. And at any given scene, the nature of the explosions in such a confined space means that we're dealing with quite literally thousands of body parts and pieces of body tissue.
I see. Do we have any idea how many explosions there have been?
Confirmed.
I'm sorry, Home Secretary, but I don't think that's an accurate picture.
Aldgate, Edgware Road, King's Cross and the bus at Tavistock Square.
I've had information about six scenes.
No, I think there are only four.
This is exactly why we need clarity.
Even when you listen to that, and that's obviously a recreation, a dramatised version of what was happening there, but it sounds very real. And the other thing that they've done very cleverly here, Chris, I thought, was we have a mixture of real footage and obviously dramatised scenes like that. We hear Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at the time, we hear his speech, and you really do get a sense of the shock of that day in July 2005.
Yeah, you really do. And it's kind of seamless too, the way they use the reconstruction.
Yeah, you don't notice it changing.
You don't, because in the first few minutes I did think to myself, I was too quick to judge, I did think, why didn't we just get a documentary about this? What is this dramatization actually going to bring to it? Quite a lot, actually. And I think the stuff about this is, I should add, it is a series about Charles, the young Brazilian man who worked as an electrician in London and was wrongly identified as a fugitive who the police or the Metropolitan London Police thought was involved in a second failed bomb attack.
They had a lot of intelligence around a potential second attack.
Yeah, a lot of intelligence, but they really knew nothing. Yeah. So he is the focus, and we come, you know, back and forth to his story.
And I think his family were involved.
They were heavily involved. They were consultants on this series, which must have made some of the scenes here very difficult to watch, because as Jen was saying at the beginning, Jeff Pope is not pulling his punches here. Like, he does show exactly what happened and the mistakes that were made that led to that led to Charles's killing that day. But also the stuff about Ian Blair, played by our own Colin Lethill, I thought was fascinating because he's depicted here as, you know, he's the head of the police, he's Sir Ian Blair at this point, and he's depicted here as a man. You heard in that clip there a meeting where
I'll come back to you, because I have a clip of him at the moment when he hears about the bombs, and they were very keen there to say, well, it's definitely four confirmed, there might be six. And then in Blair, this is him before all of that, before the scene that we just heard, Conleth Hill as in Blair.
Let me handle the media, sir. Just for now, keep you at the firing line. You know I have the experience.
Sure you have, Brian. But this is the most significant attack on the capital since the Second World War. And I'm doing it.
Well, he's putting himself personally in the firing line when information about what's happening is still sketchy. Yeah, if you get some detail wrong, it won't be the Met making a cock up, it'll be him.
What did he say to you?
Oh, he just brushed me aside off like an annoying insect.
He likes to be at the centre of things.
He should at least wait until we hear back from the guys underground.
And you can already hear the trouble that is going to cause. Conleth Hill as the commissioner, isn't he? He was the police commissioner at the time. Sir Ian Blair. And we also heard Max Beasley as this assistant of his, who was saying, just let me handle the media on this. And there are two sides to that. You get, well, he's the Ian Blair is prepared to go out there and take whatever's coming, but also he wants to be in the limelight.
There's a sense that he's enjoying it more than he should, you know, but he should be enjoying that sort of attention at that time. And, you know, he's speaking before he knows anything. He's already been told by his superiors not to step in front of a camera because they have no real grasp, no real understanding of the situation. And Conleth Hill, like, it's a great performance from Hill because he really
has all of that ambiguity there.
He's kind of like, he's showing you, you know, this man has the kind of charisma and, you know, he's done things in order. Like, he's obviously been successful at his job to get to this point, but, you know, people don't like him. He rubs people up the wrong way. And Hill is very good at playing those characters, I think.
All right. And it's on Disney Plus. How many episodes are we talking about?
Four.
There's four. And
a big focus
incredible.
on the Menzies family.
It's unbearably tension filled. Like, the first two episodes are completely streaked.
Oh, when you see those pictures.
Anxiety. And it's almost too much, because the moment where he is, you know, executed on the tube, it's the commonplace brutality of it that I found especially upsetting. So I will say, be warned of that.
Be warned.
It's truly moving, but I think it is so necessary for the audience to be the witness, because I think a lot of people think they know this story, but they don't know this story at all, because Pope's script, it hints at all, like, the incriminating, you know, the unbelievable gaps that are in that story, specifically around how, you know, this unfolded and the missing CCTV footage on the tube after he was shot. And it's really effective at reimagining those meetings, closed doors, like we just heard there. And I do think also Dan Jeffries, who did the soundtrack for Black Mirror, has to be commended about the score throughout the series. Is extremely claustrophobic and foreboding, and it adds that sense of dread to it as well. It's a really well made piece.
Stars sounds crass, but let's give them.
I'd give it a 4 out of 5, and I think it's a really powerful watch, and it adds a humanity to this story that was sorely missed from the actual events.
And it starts.
I'm kind of going to go to the same, but also going back to that idea where I worried, should they've left it to, you know, the documentary approach? But I think Pope and his team, they apply delicacy, respect, intelligence, and thoughtfulness to a story that reveals an awful lot more about something that 20 years later we thought we had seen and everything. But it's very well made. So 4 stars.
And a nuanced, I think, presentation of all of the. All all of the characters here. All right, that is the shooting. Suspect, the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menzies. It's on Disney Plus. Karim is on Apple TV Plus, and the Four Seasons, which I meant to mention, the updated version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. It's worth getting the soundtrack to listen to that alone. That's my little offering on the Four Seasons, which is currently streaming on Netflix. And now on this sunny evening, we have three albums that our reviewers, Pat Carty and Kate Brennan-Harding, have been listening to on their sun loungers, I presume, judging by the gig, the kind of relaxed atmosphere of Pat Carty before me here in the studio. And maybe that's what Kate Brennan-Harding actually is, as she's joining us on the line this evening.
That's exactly where I am.
Now, let me tell you what we're going to be talking about. Blondeshell, or Sabrina Teitelbaum, brings us If You Asked for a Picture, which is the follow-up to her acclaimed self-titled 2023 album. Real female take here, Blondeshell, gives us a subverting in many ways, I think you could argue, the macho vibe of albums like Rated R by Queens of the Stone Age, Californication by Red Hot Chili Peppers, and a whole host of other stuff. Seattle-based Car Seat Headrest bring us The Scholars, a rock opera of sorts. And we hear the story of a bunch of clown troubadours touring in a dead land. I kid you not, that is what the album is about. But we will start this evening with Suzanne Vega. Many of you will remember her from her huge success in the 1980s with tracks like Marlena on the Wall and Luca, and DNA's reinvigoration a little bit later of her a cappella version of Tom's Diner by adding a beat to it. That was in the 1990s. Now Suzanne Vega is back with Flying with Angels. It's her first album in over a decade, produced by long-term collaborator Jerry Leonard, whose distinctive guitar style I think is there to be heard right across the album. Let's have a listen to the opening track, Speaker's Corner.
Now become more like a child, bewildered and confused. I keep on believing it's what I know how to do. Speaker's Corner. Dance, politics and song. When it's time to tell your tale, don't wait too long.
Speaker's Corner, opening track from Suzanne Vega, and Flying with the Angels, Pat Carty with me in studio, and Kate Brennan-Harding joining us on the line. You were a big fan. Were you a fan back in the 80s, Pat? And what kind of feelings did you have about this album coming now as it does?
Let me see. Was I a fan in the 80s? My sister was. Didn't they go to you? She had the first album.
Thanks for not answering that question.
Yeah. I'm working around to it. Marlene on the Wall, yeah, you mentioned that. And there was another big hit, Luca, if people remember that. About, I think it was from the point of view of a boy that was being abused, which was unusual at the time, which was a new kind of thing. And as you mentioned then, Tom's Diner, which I really did not like. But it did lead to...
Did you not?
No.
One among millions that didn't like it. One among millions, the rest of the million loving it.
Yeah, well, did you know that it was used as a test prototype for the MP3 software? For the first MP3 software, which
Pat,
led
you amaze me to with Suzanne, the information.
Hold on a second. Led to Suzanne Vega being called the mother of MP3. Now, that's one of the most interesting things about Suzanne Vega, in my opinion.
Oh, Lord.
Now, she was huge here in the 80s. You remember that? And I think that Marlene on the Wall goes back to Fab Vinny on MTUSA on a Sunday afternoon. I think that's where she got her breakthrough here in this country. I might be wrong. I might be misremembering that.
Yeah, Fab Vinny, yes. But it was she who was doing the singing and the performing.
She's doing the singing there and the song we just heard and on this album. And Jerry Leonard, as you say, who was David Bowie's right-hand man towards the end of his life and a Dubliner, is the producer there, and you can hear his guitar. Bit of a Johnny Marr kind of sound to the guitar there. The problem with a lot of these songs is they're just not great songs.
I have to stop you because I can feel Kate Brennan-Harding jumping
voice,
up off
voice,
the, off, off
on,
the,
Kate,
off the sun lounge. And he says there, I spoke over you. Sorry, Pat.
The voice is a bit weak, I think.
The voice is a bit weak, is what he said. I must say, when I listened to the first track, Speaker's Corner, the first thing I wrote down was vocal, and it was complimentary. What did you think, Kate Brennan-Harding?
Okay, so I love when Pat and myself disagree. I think the thing is that I do get that there is a weakness or there is a something not giving fully in this album, but Suzanne Vega is such a legend and I think paved the way for artists like Alanis Morissette. And those artists are kind of polarizing, I think, to people. And especially Suzanne Vega and Alanis Morissette, to be gendered about it will appeal more to women because of how she delivers what she's trying to say. Now, I will say that this album... I really enjoyed it, but not to the point or to the level I thought I was going to enjoy it. I do actually really like her vocal on Speaker's Corner. I also like what she's trying to say about it. Speaker's Corner, the theme about it is basically because of social media, everybody has a platform and everybody has a voice. But unfortunately, those voices are not necessarily truthful, according to Vega, or that, you know, there's so much out there, it's very difficult to actually hear anyone speaking from the Speaker's Corner. So I love that she's going back into speaking about kind of what's going on currently with her own style and her own nuance. And I really like the vocals. And what I really like as well, I agree, Pat, completely, there's a Johnny Marr-esque thing to it. I think the more you listen to Jerry Leonard and the more you listen to this album, you can hear Leonard's influence on Bowie as well, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Excuse me. Okay, so a different opinion on Speaker's Corner. Mm. But lyrically, I think, am I right in thinking, Pat, that lyrically do you think there are things said on this album, important things?
Well, I don't know about important things. I'll tell you one. There is one song that I thought was excellently put together, with Last Train from Mariupol, which is
that beautiful. Yeah,
about the Ukrainian conflict. And what she's talking about a train leaving the city. It's a city in the southern region of Ukraine. And she says everybody's leaving and God himself was on the last train out of Mariupol, you know. And that's
it's
also
very
the
simple.
Way,
it's an acoustic guitar.
Yeah, but the guitar sounds like a bandura. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which is a Ukrainian stringed instrument anyway, you know. So that's certainly thematically, and you can't argue with the message, you know.
No, absolutely not. Well, go on,
Kate. What's interesting about that song is it was actually recorded 3 years ago, two and a half years ago. And therefore, there's some parts of this album I feel must have been similar to that, where they were recorded or they were written a number of years ago. And that's what I feel about the album. It's kind of a bit patchwork. Mm. There are so many parts that are good. There's parts then I don't understand why they've been placed in the album. They don't fit in the sequence of things. That's where I come from in terms of a criticism. Well, and it's just a taste thing, I guess. I'm kind of like, there's a lot of trying here on this. You know?
Tell me a little bit about Chambermaid, which is a kind of what would you say? Is it a retort to Bob Dylan and the 1960 songs, I Want You? 66 song?
It very much takes the melody from it. There's a chambermaid in that song, that's I Want You by Bob Dylan, 1966, Blonde on Blonde, which is a better album than this one, let's be honest. And
Dylan, come on.
Anyway, the chambermaid goes by in the song, it's only just briefly mentioned. And so what Suzanne Vega does, rather cleverly, admittedly, is she takes the part of the chambermaid and who's cleaning up after Dylan, you know, and she asks, did I ever steal anything? No, he never leaves anything out.
Nothing valuable enough to steal. Let's have a listen to a little bit of Chambermaid. There we go, Suzanne Vega. Really living in my opinion, acting into that character of the chambermaid incredibly well. But you can hear the Dylan influences for sure. One song that I do want to mention, Kate, I wondered how you felt about it as an inhabitant of Galway.
Here we go.
Yourself. It's the final song on the album. I would argue a good place for it to have been put.
Yeah.
Or the studio, maybe, or something like that. Sorry, Kate.
Yeah, go ahead, Kate. Like
it's a love story in a way about not finding love in the west of Ireland, about not moving there. It's folk, it's trad. It's nice, but that's as much as I can say about it. Mm. I mean, at least it's not as bad as Ed Sheeran's Galway Girl, but... Yeah. It wouldn't be this is what I was saying about, I don't see where some of these songs fit. Yeah.
It's not going to be an anthem for Galway.
It's not going to be an anthem. And having said that, I feel like I'm being unnecessarily cruel when I don't mean to be. I do think there's so many lovely things on the album. I do think Suzanne Vega fans will love it, but there's certain songs you're like, not sure why that's there.
All right. Stars from you on this one, Kate.
This is 3 out of 5 for me.
3 out of 5. Pat, you love the Galway song.
Well, I just want to say that she does say to her daughter in the Galway song, she says to her that your father could have been Irish, which is a great honour to bestow on anyone, surely, you know. But I'd have to say I think as a lover of Galway, I think the city deserves better than that. What would I give this album? I give it 2 out of 5. It's not terrible, but I couldn't see myself going home and putting it on again.
All right, let's move on to album number 2 tonight. Comes from Blonde Shell, stage name of American singer-songwriter Sabrina Teitelbaum. Her new album is called If You Ask for a Picture. Let's have a listen, not the opening track, but to a track called T&A. And it happened.
Your tits.
TNA track from Blondshell's new album, If You Asked for a Picture. Kate, maybe you'd give us a little bit of Blondshell's background and the origins of that album title.
Yes, of course. Well, she's new enough to most people's ears. She first released an album, I think it was 2 years ago. She is one of those people that people are like really hyped up about in terms of how she expresses herself, what she's writing about, and also how she sort of takes grungy sounds and, you know, older sounds and sort of more masculine sounds and turns it into her own energy. But I think that this song is very interesting because the album title comes from a poet, Mary Oliver, and she wrote a poem called Dogfish. And it says, if you asked for a picture, I would have to draw you a smile under the perfectly round eyes and above the chin, which was rough as a thousand sharpened nails. So that's where she's drawing her inspiration. She's kind of taking fragments of her experience in life, her emotional kind of experiences, but only parts, and sort of putting a shining a light on them. And this, I think there's a video for TNA, which is really interesting. It's about rescue dogs being introduced to each other. So bear with me on this. But there is male dogs and female dogs being introduced to each other, and how the male dogs are really barking and they're really angry and they're really, like, you know, aggressive. But actually, underneath it, they're big softies and they're just really, really scared.
And the narrative.
Exactly. But that, I really think that that's a really important narrative for a woman singing, to recognize, you know, that the more you bark, maybe you're actually the person that's insecure and vulnerable. And that's what's coming out here.
I have to say, TNA, I kind of, and there are explicit lyrics a little bit later on in the song, and I went off looking this up thinking, oh God, I hope I'm not going to find something here that, but it stands for time and attendance in the world of business. But even more interestingly, it's in the world of medicine, it stands for tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy.
Well, I mean, hats off. That's some good research.
I'm presuming it's time and attendance.
What I got was a pretty bad Rolling Stones song. You don't hear me say that often, called Little TNA. That was on Tattoo You in 1980.
That's the reference, is it?
Written by Keith Richards for his then new wife. And I think the TNA refers to parts of our anatomy, I'll be honest with you. And I think that's what it is. I mean, I well played.
Tonsils and adenoids.
Well, possibly,
it is,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes. No, it is.
top of your head and your ankle or something like that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly. But that's
your derriere.
Exactly.
Right. I'm so innocent.
Yeah. I'd say that's what it is.
Okay.
Still pretty good, though. It's a good song.
And you have to say, when I listen to that song in isolation, I forget the feeling I got when I first listened to the opening tracks of this album. I thought, oh, this is interesting. But then let's go down to track 8. And when I got here, the track is called Change, and my mind started to change too. Have it, and that is Change from Blondshell's new album, If You Asked for a Picture. And it was then again, Kate Brennan Harding, you know, as I listened to it there in isolation, it's not a problem. But when I was listening through the album, I kind of found it very tonally, very similar right across, particularly from about track 6 onwards.
I completely agree. Like, I was listening away, and I was also kind of like, I really want to give this more. Maybe I'm not in the right mood to be listening to it. And over the last few days, I've been like, no, there's too much similarity, too much tonality that I don't know if she's expanding into where she maybe should be going. And maybe she's suffering from that second album syndrome, which I hate quoting, because a lot of people quote that and it's not necessarily true. But with this album, I feel like she could have been more expansive, could have been more adventurous.
Stars?
Out of 5, 3 out of 5 for me.
3 out of 5. I must also mention Event of Fire, which is real touches of Dolores O'Riordan and the Cranberries, and that's no bad thing. Stars from you on this one, Pat, overall?
Not as immediate as her first album, which we reviewed here, which I'm sure you remember.
Yeah, and you were very positive about it.
I was very positive about it. Yeah, there was a song called Veronica Mars on it. See how I remember these things? It was a great song. I like that TNA that we played. Yeah. And I like several of the songs on this.
Yeah.
But I agree with both of you. It does get a bit samey when you listen to the whole thing. So I still think it's good, though. 3.
3. Okay. Okay, Pat Carty and Suzanne, I was going to call you Suzanne Vega, Kate Brennan Harding are still with me. We've had two albums, Suzanne Vega and Blondshell. Now we're on to Car Seat Headrest and an album called The Scholars. Perhaps it should be the other way around. The band should be called The Scholars and the album called Car Seat Headrest. Anyway, they're being fairly experimental on this album, Pat.
It's a rock opera. So everybody come back to the radios now. Don't run away.
And a concept.
Yeah, concept, yeah. And now the concept, hold on a second. I had to look this up because you wouldn't be able to tell, I don't think, too clearly by listening to the record, because your man isn't the clearest of vocalists. But it starts off, it's supposed to be based, I know the last, what's her name? Blonde. What's her name, Kate?
Blondshell.
Yeah. Blondshell, right. Blondshell. That was based on a poem, the name. But this guy, Toledo, the lead singer of this band, claims that this is based on an unpublished poem written by my great-great-great-great-grandfather, the Archbishop Guillermo Guadalupe del Toledo. And the lyrics then bring in a large cast of characters, including this fella called Devereaux, who's the son of a backwater religious conservative who struggles with his sexuality and sets off to seek his own fortunes.
We want the listeners to stay for another wee while.
Sets off to seek his own fortunes at a nearby clown college. It's a clown college they go to.
It's called, is it the Parnassus University or the University of Parnassus?
Mickey D's Parnassus. University, maybe. The Scholars is obviously in inverted commas then, I presume.
Okay.
But concept album, which is never, not always a bad thing. Quadrophenia by The Who, Ziggy Stardust by Bowie. And this is a game of two halves.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Okay, and The Who is easy to say.
Yeah.
Bowie, easy to say. Car Seat Headrest.
Yeah, it's a terrible name.
It's a shocking name.
It's down there with elbow or ham sandwich or something.
Let's have a listen to a track called Lady Gay, approximately.
Tremble silently and wait and wait, and finally he finds something, some words.
Lady Gay, approximately from the album The Scholars from Car Seat Headrest. Kate Brennan Harding. The concept here, you see, the problem I had with this in some ways, I was listening to it, and again, when you listen to the songs in isolation, you say, you know what, I can begin to hear a story in the midst of that. Mm. But some of the songs were so long, and to be listening to it purely without any visuals or any kind of stage cue, or stage visuals to be looking at, I found it a hard listening in that respect.
Yeah, I agree. The thing is, there's a song called Gethsemane on it. It's 11 minutes, and there's an accompanying video with that. And it tells a really interesting story around a woman called Rosa, who is discovered that she has medicinal and sort of psychic healing powers. Yeah. So the video that accompanies it, you can follow along with that. There's another track that's 19 minutes long. There's some of it that kind of, it dips in and out. And it very much is each character is kind of coming to the fore and taking stage. For me, as a body of work, it's a very interesting thing to do, considering Car Seat Headrest are after taking on a load of new younger listeners in the last couple of years. And now they've released this. So it's very brave in a way, but I think it's almost too navel-gazy. It's too trying hard. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like they've believed their own hype. And I'm kind of like, musicality-wise, it's good in some places, but you do get lost and you do get like, oh my God, when is this over?
Yeah, would you be happier, Pat, if you saw a stage version of this or a film version of this, perhaps?
Of a rock musical about clown college? I'm not sure if I'd be queuing up for tickets for that, but I'd have to say about this record, and it's a good point the two you're making, that just to listen to it as, you know, ignore that and listen to it as an album. I think half of this is pretty good. Mm. I think the second half, it shoots itself in the foot by what Kate was saying there about these songs. 18 minutes. Like, you're listening to that. Like, I was listening to that 18-minute long one, and I was making a slice of toast or something and around. I said, that's changing, you know, changes movements within the songs. Yeah. And I thought to myself, oh yeah, that must nearly be over. And I looked at the thing, and it was only 5 minutes. I had another 13 minutes to go on this one song. But the opening song, CCF, I'm not sure what that stands for, I'm going to stay with you, is about 8 or 9 minutes long. That's a good song. I like the way it builds up. It's got touches of Peter Gabriel on the vocals and The Who. You know, so half of it is good.
Yeah, half of it's good.
And then when they get carried away, they get too far.
Stars.
Stars. I give it 3.5 for the ambition alone.
Okay. And what are you saying, Kate?
I think, you know, fans of Beck and Matt Berninger and kind of that kind of put it on and like get really stuck into your own world. will enjoy it. For me, I originally gave it a 3 out of 5, but I'm going to give it a 2 out of 2.5 out of 5.
All right, you've dropped somewhat there. That is Kate Brennan-Hardy and Pat Carty speaking to us this evening about Suzanne Vega, Flying with the Angels. Blonde Shell, If You Ask for a Picture, and Car Seat Headrest, The Scholars. By the way, an old colleague of mine used to say that the way indie bands name themselves is 3 random words. And we thought, that's a great bad name. Car Seat Headrest obviously had the same idea.
Must Try Harder, I think.
Yeah, Must Try Harder is another one. Let us go to tonight's competition. We asked you about who played the character of Mozart in the film Amadeus, and his name has gone clean out of my head. Pat Carty, who played the character of Amadeus in the film? Tom Hulce played the character, beg your pardon. And Susie Cantwell is our competition winner this evening, and she will be going off to the National Concert Hall to hear Julian Bliss playing the Mozart Clarinet Concerto and a host of other Mozart masterpieces. But that is our lot for this evening. Sound supervision was by Niall McMonagall. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was researched by Paula Shields, and the show was produced by Reg Luby. I'll be back with you on Monday. We're looking back at some of our great interviews of recent times, and don't forget Tuesday night, the Big Bank Holiday. The big Tuesday special, Studio One with Keela and the Paul Frost Brass Band. Enjoy your bank holiday weekend, whatever you do get up to. Let's hope the weather keeps up. Oh, I fear it might be about to break. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Enjoy yourselves, and in the meantime, stay tuned for Ray Cuddihy, who will be with you after the news.